everybody. This is Ava Montaigne. Today's speaker is a world-renowned speaker, plant explorer, artful garden writer, and skilled plantsman. He is the senior curator and at Denver Botanical Gardens and director of outreach there. And it's through the Denver Botanic Gardens that I got to know this speaker. I went on a horticultural tour of South Africa with him as the guide a few years ago. I'd seen him speak a couple times previous to that, and he doesn't know this, but I told friends of mine when I told them about the trip that I felt like I could be closed in a dark room with him without any plants and just listen to him talk and absorb so much information that it would be a huge boost for me in every way. So needless to say, the experience to South Africa was an amazing one. I gained a wealth of knowledge, and our speaker is himself a wealth of knowledge and an entertaining speaker too. I'm very pleased to have him on the call with us, and I am grateful and honored to be able to call him a friend. I'm glad to share him with all of you today. So without further ado, Panayoti Kaledis, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Eva. It's a real pleasure to be doing this. It's a novelty for me. I've never done anything quite like this, so it's never too late to learn something new, right?
That's right. That's what I hope anyway. It's pretty exciting. So I'm just going to start out by asking you a few basic questions to get us going, and then I'll hand it over to you. And in the meantime, the speakers can, or the audience can, get the link going that we already sent you for the slideshow presentation that Panayoti will be referring to through his talk in a few minutes. So first off, Panayoti, I'd like you to tell us where and how you first started gardening, how this came to be your passion and your career path.
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. There's a book that's going to be coming out this spring called Why I Garden by Timber Press, and I wrote a chapter that actually answers that question. But I hate to have everybody out there feel like they have to go buy the book, so I'll let you know. That way you'll see whether you think it's worth buying the book. But I grew up in Boulder, which is a very beautiful setting, and I had a brother-in-law who's still a very dear friend of mine. He just turned 80, but he had just gotten married to my sister, who was a good deal older than me at the time. She was 18. I was just when I was born, actually, and so she was probably 25 or 6 when they got married, and they lived in my the house where I was growing up, and my brother-in-law built a large garden while he was living in the house, and I helped him, and it was just, I just idolized him, and I thought he was the most wonderful thing in the world, and building the garden was the most fun thing in the world, and I guess the bottom line is that is really why I garden, and I can blame Alan for it. His name is Alan Taylor. He made me realize just how much fun it was to garden.
Excellent. That's terrific. So at that point, was it vegetables and perennials and the whole bit?
No. I started off with rock plants. And I tell the anecdote more fully because it really has a certain amount of drama to it. He went off and left me to take care of the garden. And I just sweated beads because he was my hero. When your hero tells you to take care of something. So I read every book I could. And by the time I was 10 years old, I probably knew most of the wildflowers of Colorado that are showy and interesting by Latin name. And I knew most of the common rock garden plants, you know, thoroughly. I'd read all these books. And you know how a little kid, when they get intent about something. So I started with alpines. And I have to admit, I've never let up. I'm still very keen on alpine plants. Since that time, I've discovered vegetables and many other things as well. But it's a little unusual for people to begin their passion for gardening with the very most difficult plants in some ways to grow.
Yes, I agree. I've come to know rock gardening somewhat myself and be interested in it, but it's been a journey. I started with vegetables, like a lot of people. I think that's really neat to know about your past. And I'd like you to tell us now about where you garden now, your personal garden, the elevation, since that's such a factor here in the interior West. And figures into the zone, USDA hardiness zone, like we've talked about in previous talks and all that, and what your native soil is like where you garden now.
Sure. Well, I used to garden at the Botanic Gardens. Of course, I've been booted upstairs, so now I'm just a spokesperson, and I just watch all the other people having fun. But because I'm a chronic and a pretty desperate gardener, I have to get my hands dirty. Almost every day, if I don't, something's wrong. I moved into the house I'm living in now in 1994, so I've been there about, oh my heavens, it's approaching 18 years. It's hard to believe it's that long, but long time. And it's taken a long time to create the garden there. I gardened for many years with my ex-wife, and she actually did a lot of the garden design. Her name is Gwen Moore, and she has a great deal of sort of talent. The soil is pure sand, 80 feet deep, because it's on an old kind of sandbar at the edge of Cherry Creek. We're on the hill above Cherry Creek. As a consequence, it's drainage is not a problem. You could have water pouring on it pretty much nonstop anywhere in the garden, and it would never pool up. So that presents lots of problems, as you can imagine. It's kind of on a south-facing slope, so it gets the full angle of the sun. It's a dry garden. Even where we water is kind of dry, but we've done a great deal of composting in various spots, especially with the perennial beds and the vegetable garden. But there's no way, with water bills being what they are, that we could do the whole thing irrigated. So much of it is minimally or not irrigated. And that makes it a wonderful place for me to experiment with drought-tolerant and native plants.
Yes, definitely, I would say. Well, you do a beautiful job. I've had the pleasure of visiting your garden, and I don't know if you might have recognized it, but the banner for the this whole teleseries actually is from a photo I took when I visited your garden at home.
And I realize I never didn't tell you the elevation. You asked about that.
Yeah.
It's in southeast Denver, and we're just about the same elevation as the Capitol. So it's right at about a mile elevation, 5280. And I'm glad. I'm glad that you commented. And yes, I think you've been to my garden several times. And I love to open it up, and it's been featured with the Garden Conservancy tour just recently, but I usually get 3 or 4 tours a year.
Great. Yeah, it's quite a public service that you do by opening up your garden. We all appreciate that, those of us who have had the opportunity to visit it. So, Panayoti, what USDA hardiness zone do you consider your home garden to be in, just to tie it in with the other talks here?
Well, the USDA hardiness zones are somewhat controversial in various people's books. I think they're useful. I used to be one of those people who thought that they were just all nonsense. But as time has come on, I think they actually do work very well. Denver is basically, I think, is now listed as borderline 6 in parts of Denver and 5B. And I think my house is a little colder than the Botanic Gardens. I'd say it's a good 5B zone.
Okay, great. And then I wonder if you, well, there's two questions usually, but I'm going to tie it into one because of how you got your start to gardening being so unique. I wonder if you had an aha moment on your way to the understanding you have today that you're about to launch into here for the rest of our time together. And how you were introduced to the methods that you teach now. If perhaps that it didn't really happen the same way for you as it did with other people since you kind of grew up doing it. But if you have something you could speak to about that, that would be great.
Sure, sure. Well, I have about an aha moment about gardening about 10 times a day. So picking out which aha moment to tell you first, that's for me, that's really what gardening is about, is this look, this sense of this shock of recognition. I have had many, many, many. I mean, I started gardening with these little rock garden plants in this rock garden, but I really fell in love with woodland plants because I lived in a shady garden in Boulder. We had a lot of big trees. And I realized right off the bat that the best plants for me to grow in much of the yard would be shade-loving plants. So I fell in love with eastern woodland plants, which is terribly, really challenging. You know, if you think one thing harder than alpines to grow in Colorado, it's woodland plants from the east, right?
Yeah,
well, it wasn't so hard in Boulder. So, but my aha moments over the years, some of them have been a realization that how incredibly rich our native Western flora is. And my biggest aha moment that keeps recurring in many forms and is realizing how much we can do with what we have and how many of our so-called problems here are really blessings. Our soils, for example, people always say how terrible our soils are. Well, our soils are not terrible if you're trying to grow the kinds of plants that we should be growing. So there's an aha moment, like I said, all the time. And one of my first really big ones was as a little kid. I would go off in March almost every year to visit my brother and sisters in California. And we would leave Colorado in March, which, you know, is pretty stark and pretty glum in Colorado. And we go to California, and California was at the height of spring. So I had this huge aha, which was, oh, my God, California is so beautiful, and Colorado is so ugly. I mean, that was an aha that I had. Well, of course, it wasn't true. Colorado is every bit as beautiful as California. It's just that after a long winter, you're ready for that lushness, and that lushness drew me in. Years later, I realized that in the summertime, California is burnt to a crisp, and Colorado is very beautiful, and the mountains are very lush. Even down in the low areas, we have our lush moments. But I've come to realize my biggest aha is that green is just one of many colors, and it's not about creating a green landscape per se. It's about creating a beautiful landscape. Mm-hmm. So that's been my biggest aha, is to learn to embrace our semi-arid steppe climate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would sure say, and I know many people would agree with me, that you've done a marvelous job of that. And it's funny you mentioned California. I spent some years of my life there before moving to Colorado, and it was in the cloudy, foggy redwoods on the extreme north coast. And I knew coming to Colorado, I was trading something a lot of growing season, but the way I looked at it was that I was trading the green of the flora for the blue of the sky. And I really think the colorful Colorado state motto captures what we have here very well. I think it's terrific. So I'm glad that you are here to teach us more about that very thing. So you're going to talk to us a bit about steppe climates today. And I have let people know in the audience that this whole series would be available to them pretty low tech by telephone. So there may be a few people tuning in with us that will not have access to the slides. So if you can, as much as possible, you know, say what's on the slide too, the slides will just be an enrichment for people. So.
Sure. Yeah, but I don't think there's anything on the slides that can't be conveyed pretty well in words. And the first slide, of course, is the perfect example. All I do is list what the characteristics are of the steppe climate. Steppe is a word that is not utilized as much as it should be, or as it will be, I think. Most people think of the steppes of Asia being where Genghis Khan, you know, had this golden horde. And if they think about it at all, it's usually in association with horses and the Ukraine and Cossacks or something. Well, in fact, Central Asia and really from the Caucasus all the way to Manchuria, there's this huge belt of earth that is called steppe in Russian. And it is the exact correlative to what we have in much of the United States. About a third of the United States is very much like the steppes of Central Asia. It's probably the largest single portion of the United States climatic region, encompassing the tall grass prairie, the short grass prairie, and then the whole inner mountain sort of region. So what makes steppe? It's basically four things. It's continental in its climate, in the sense that it has really cold winters, usually well below zero Fahrenheit, and really hot summers. That's one of the things that a steppe climate always is characterized by, these extremes of cold and heat. And then the second thing is rainfall. Steppes are not deserts. Desert is something else again. Desert usually is less than 10 inches of rainfall in our kind of weather regime, whereas most steppes climates really have between 10 and 25 inches of rainfall. So they usually have a little more rain than deserts. And that's, but people call them the deserts, just like the first explorers who came out to Colorado, the long expedition characterized the Great Plains as the Great American Desert, which shows you that the misunderstanding goes way back. Then another characteristic of steppe regions is that they have different kind of soils than maritime climates. Wetter climates tend to have acid soils, whereas steppe climates have very rich soils with lots of nutrients because they have not been leached, and they tend to be high in calcium and other minerals. So they're actually given a name called pedocal. That's what characterizes the soils in steppe regions, and that's what most of us have in our yards. Almost anybody in Colorado who has a garden, their soil is unique from the kinds of soils you have in wet regions, and they are much richer soils. That's one of the problems, is that people don't know how to handle them. You have to be careful because it's easy to kind of over-fertilize and abuse them. Finally, steppe regions are characterized by intense wind and intense solar insolation. The sun really, really beats down on us, and the wind makes a huge factor. So all these together combine to sort of describe the climate here, certainly in Colorado, but also realize that we're not alone. Much of the United States has a similar climate, and then we have similar climates around the world, and we can learn a great deal by taking a look at those places and their conditions.
Great. And I know that the pedocals, it sounds like the mineral-rich clay soil I have in my backyard. Is that, can pedocals be clay as well as the sand like you described in your yard?
Yeah, well, I think that characterizes pedocals is the fact that they tend to be mineral soils, either clay or sandy. They don't tend to be those big, those rich loamy type soils that people associate with the tall grass prairie so much. Although there are places where, in the steppes, where you do have more loamy soils, they tend to be more mineral, and that's one of the things that characterizes them. The other real characteristic of pedocals, of course, is the fact that they are not leached because we don't get as much rainfall. There tends to be quite a bit in the way of nutrients in them. So you have to be careful. You know, some people, for example, they if you live in Connecticut or in Illinois, people are always liming their lawns. Well, what it means to lime your lawns is that in acid regions, the acid rain and the water leaches the soil and makes it incredibly acid, which is what grass doesn't like that. Grass needs calcium. So they have to try and turn their soils into pedocals, and that's what a lot of what people are doing in humid climates. Well, you do that in Colorado, you know, adding lime to our soils is like coals to Newcastle. The last thing in the world they need is more lime. So people have to be reeducated that they're not in Connecticut anymore, you know. We live in a different world here, and you have to really come to appreciate what we have and understand it to really succeed.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, thanks. And then I forgot to tell you too, Panayoti, we'll need to let people know when they should change the slides, since everyone will be doing that.
Oh, okay. Very good. Sure. Well, we kind of talked about the points on the last slide, so if you'd like to move on to the second one,
sure.
We can continue the theme of steppes. And I mentioned that there are similar steppe climates around the world. And if you look at a map of the world, like the one on the second slide, I just highlight the four principal steppe climates. And on this particular map, they're shown in a kind of a tannish color, and I have arrows pointing to four spots on the globe. The on the upper left-hand side, you have Western American prairie and intermountain shrubland, and I kind of show where that is. And on the right-hand side, much of Asia, really, you can see from Turkey all the way to Manchuria, there's this all that tan that you see in there, and all that kind of golden brown is the Western and Central Asian steppe, which is one of the largest biomes. As you can see, that occupies a huge amount of space. And that is a very important area because many of our garden plants that we're already growing originated there. If you think about lilacs, many of the roses that we grow, the shrub roses, many of the things like the bearded irises, many of the plants that really do well for us, peonies, for example. Most people think of peonies as being sort of oriental. Well, they're oriental. They're from Mongolia. That's where the wild ancestor of our garden peonies comes from, is from Inner Mongolia. So no wonder it does so well for us in our gardens. I've actually seen peonies growing in a garden in Denver that is not irrigated. So they're incredibly drought tolerant if they have a good, rich, deep soil. And so the Central Asia has a great deal of importance to our traditional flora, but it also has many plants that we have not grown yet that are proving to be incredibly fabulous plants for our gardens. A good example is foxtail lilies, Aramurus. They're entirely restricted to that zone of the steppes of Asia. That's the only place they grow in nature. And in Colorado, they just love it. If you come to Denver Botanic Gardens in June, I've often said that we should rename Denver Botanic Gardens and call it Foxtail Botanic Gardens, because we have hundreds, maybe even thousands of these beautiful, huge, they're like big spires of lilies that come in yellow and white and cream and pink and bronze, and they're just fantastic. And there's dozens more that we have yet to cultivate. At any rate, so that's Central Asia, and that's, as we can see, that's the biggest of all the steppe climates. The Southern Hemisphere has two very significant steppe regions. South Africa, most of the interior part of the country of South Africa is an area called Karoo, and it's virtually the same biome again. It's a little milder in climate generally than what we have in Colorado, but it still is steppe. They do get extreme cold and extreme heat. And that is, South Africa is about twice the size of Texas, and the big central part, the size that's even bigger than Texas, is this steppe region there. And finally, the last bit of steppe in the world, the last major area, and the one that we've done the least work in up to now, is in the Andes. The foothills of the Andes on the Argentine side are called, of course, the Patagonian steppe. And Patagonia, most of Patagonia is very much correlative to what we have in Colorado. But we probably have fewer plants from there than any of the other regions. But it's an area that I think has great promise in the future. So these four areas, if you look at them, they have a lot to teach us because, you know, you look at what you have in your backyard, you don't see it clearly. But when you look at a different place and see these same kinds of plants, the same kinds of habits, it teaches you that maybe there's a pattern there that can help help you understand our conditions better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one other thing I wanted to add in about why I think it's so valuable is, or that I think it's valuable is when I was still in California, I went to a gardening symposium there that was all about Mediterranean regions. Of course, that's what I was living in at the time, and they did this very thing, connected all the Mediterranean regions on a map of the world and showed us plants that we garden with from all those places. And it was such an intriguing and fairly new concept to me. And then I moved to Colorado, and it was years, honestly, of trying to access information like this before I heard you talk, Panayoti, and talk about this concept in relation to the climate we have here. And I just think it's a fabulous way to wrap your brain around the bigger picture of where we garden and what resources we have to learn from. I think it's perfect.
Well, that's very interesting, because the very next slide, if you look at the next slide where I talk about the steppe sisters, what I point out is that the Mediterranean climates are well known. There have been many, many books have been done about them. Lots has been, research has been done. there's actually symposia all over the world about the sister climates in the Mediterranean. Well, it just so happens that all Mediterranean climates are twinned with a steppe climate next to them. And I call them the steppe sisters, and that's what the label of the slide is. And as you can see, I point out the California floristic province, for example, is the Mediterranean climate of California, and it's virtually the entire state of California, a little ways into Mexico, a little ways into Oregon, perhaps. But that has about 7,000 kinds of plants. It's one of the richest areas, but it's right next to the steppe part of America, which is even richer. There's more species of plants in the plains and the prairies, and if you take the whole Rocky Mountain region and its sister climates, and they're really, it's a steppe sister. And you find the same thing in the northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. The steppe region is always just to the east because of the nature of the prevailing westerlies. The east is where the clouds rise up and things get drier and colder on all four continents. So just to the east of the Mediterranean region, the original Mediterranean climate, are the steppes of Asia. And just in South Africa, you have the Mediterranean Cape Province, which is in the very south and west end of South Africa, which again, just to the east of that is the Karoo, or the steppe of South Africa. And likewise, if you look in South America, you have in Chile, you have the Mediterranean coastal flora of Chile, and you have to go over the Andes, but then Patagonia in Argentina constitutes the steppe part of South America. So that's the whole steppe sister concept, and it does help to think of the Mediterranean as you did and study it, because there's actually a great deal of commonality between these steppe sisters. Many of the same plants that grow in California grow in the steppe as well, and we actually succeed with many Mediterranean plants because they are genetically often very closely related to the steppe plants.
I didn't know that. That's very interesting. Learn about from that perspective too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find this geobotany with this, you know, botanical geography sort of thing, it seems a little theoretical, but when you start mapping it onto the ground, you realize that there's a lot of practical ideas. Really, the plants will teach you, and the climates really, really do contain this kernel of truth.
Yeah, it's very interesting and expansive. I just love it. Just seems like endless possibilities. You see what's at the nursery, but then you realize there's all these other places in the world that plants live in a very similar climate, and it just seems like it's limitless. It's exciting, probably especially for a plant explorer like yourself who gets to go to those regions and find them and bring back the winners for us.
Well, I think it's been a lot of this sort of theoretical construct has helped me really motivate my research to find out, you know, just how valid it is. In the course of which I came up with something which I think may be unique. I have not seen it anywhere else. And if you look at the next slide, I have a Fenn diagram. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's V-E-N-N. Those are where you get those circles that overlap, and they use them a lot in various kinds of presentations showing relationships. Most everybody has used these at one point or another. And I did a Fenn diagram to try and show what makes steppe so significant is that it really represents an interesting blend. So if you did three circles that overlap on over each other, and if you label one circle a maritime climate, I color that one red, and then you have two other circles that overlap with the maritime. On the left-hand side, you can see I labeled the circle Mediterranean climate, and on the right-hand side, I labeled it desert. This is actually a very good, you could overlay this diagram pretty much on all the continents where these various climates occur. And the steppe really represents the transition between Mediterranean, maritime, and desert. And the steppe is this sort of intermediate area, and that's one of the reasons why it's a little hard for people to understand. what it translates to, all of this sort of gobbledygook I just said, just think about it. What it means is that our climate is really relates very much to the other climates. In other words, if you're in a desert climate, the maritime climate is like the opposite. The humid climate is rain all the time, desert is nothing, but we're in between. And what that means is that our climate, sometimes we kind of are maritime. The last 2 or 3 years, we've actually had over 20 inches of rainfall in Denver. So we're technically approaching humid at certain times of the year. And yet we'll go through a climate a couple of years where sometimes we get only 6 or 7 inches of rainfall as we did in the early part of the decade. So technically we're actually desert for a few years. So here we are for a few years, Denver is almost like desert. And then for a few years, we're almost like humid. That is step. Our plants have to adapt to extremes. And one of the things, the extremes they have to adapt to is the fact that this climate is not uniform. So that's one of the reasons why when we select plants, placing them in the garden becomes crucial, because you can plant them in a wet year and they'll thrive, but then if that spot is particularly exposed or against a wall when a series of dry years come, that might not be the best place to plant such a plant. So you really have to be sensitive to what we call microclimate in our climate, because in England, it doesn't really matter where you plunk your rhododendron, it's going to grow. Put it on the south side of your house, the north side. But the hotter and more extreme the climate, the more you have to be sensitive. So I always say that in Colorado, the north side of your house is Alaska, and the south side of your house is Arizona. That's how extreme our climate is. You can actually grow Alaskan plants pretty easily on the north side of a house where they don't get too much sun. And you can grow certain things that would otherwise be very tender where they get that extra reflected heat on the south side. So being sensitive to microclimate, that's one of the real tenets of STEP. Is that making sense? Did I horrify you?
No, I was just letting you have the stage. No,
okay.
It makes a lot of
sense. I was a little worried there. There was a little silence. So.
Sorry.
I think that notion, the truth is that we all know that. I don't think I've said anything that isn't pretty obvious, but it's funny that there's a difference between, you know, knowing something sort of intellectually and knowing it on a gut level. Well, for the gardener, you've really got to get that microclimate is really what rules gardening in our climate. You have to be very aware of how the sun falls on your land, what areas are going to be really, really shady and wet in the winter, what areas are particularly hot with reflected sun in the summer.
Mm-hmm. I have heard that, and something to the effect of that analogy before about Alaska and Arizona, and I think I took it as a little more metaphorical than literal before right now, so that it is helpful to make me realize mm-hmm. how extreme it really is and how it should be taken more literally from the sounds of it. And it also mm-hmm. makes me think of a question I wanted to ask you about the geography, Panayoti, as far as people that didn't have that world map in front of them. Can you outline the states that are at the perimeters of our STEP region in this country? Does it go up to Montana and even further north?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No. If I had to draw a line, I would use as the west side, the very western extremity would be the summits of the Sierra and the Cascades. You know, when you get beyond the Sierra Cascade crest on the west side, that's where all the rainfall's dumped. So that's really a maritime or sometimes a Mediterranean climate. But as soon as you cross those Sierra Cascades into the Intermountain region, all of the west, all of Idaho, all the way down to most of northern Arizona, northern New Mexico, all the way to the 100th meridian. Now, where you market on the east side of the country is where it gets interesting, because what really governs the STEP climate, I think, in the Midwest is forest. If it's forested, the forest really does alter the microclimate. But wherever you get a prairie, technically those prairies are really a steppe manifestation because they have the wind, they have the exposure, they have the climate is more extreme in these meadowy-like environments. So I consider that the steppe regions really extend well into the Midwest, wherever there's an open area. That's what I would consider steppe. And I think that a lot of the workers, geographical workers, would agree with me. They would put it at least as far as Illinois. But I even think further west in parts of Ohio and Indiana, wherever you get these balls and these open areas and along the lake shores, those habitats are far more like steppe than they are maritime because the plants are subjected to the extremes of the wind and the exposure to the cold. So, again, it's microclimate translated on macroclimate.
So the humidity of the Midwest doesn't negate the potential of it being considered steppe.
Well, obviously, you know, like I said, certain years in Colorado, we get a tremendous amount of rain in the Denver area. It's still a steppe climate. It's just a wetter year. When you get to places like Kansas, Nebraska, they do get a lot more rain than we do, and you start getting little forested areas along the rivers. But once you get up onto the prairies there, the humidity, you know, is higher than it is in Denver, but it's still a lot lower than it is further east or further south. And they do get long periods of extreme dryness in those regions. Last summer, I know my friends in Kansas, I visited Kansas in June, and I kept in touch with some of my friends. They had virtually no rainfall in June or July, well into August in much of Kansas last year. So it was desperately hot and dry. There ain't nothing humid about that.
Yeah, that's for sure. And then one more question before we move on to the next slide, which is in relation then to the forests you talk about. There are so many forests on our mountains throughout the Rockies and the Cascades and, you know, the whole Intermountain West. Is it only generally steppe up to the foothills and then above that it's considered something different?
Well, that's a really good question, and there was a time I would have said, the steppe is only at low elevations. But I can give you an anecdote that I think will really give you an aha of what steppe is really all about. About 12 years ago, we had an international conference at Denver Botanic Gardens. It was a Botanic Gardens conference, you know, the North American Botanic Gardens Association met at the Botanic Gardens here in Denver, and we had hundreds and hundreds, like 600 or 700 people from all over the world came to that, including 12 directors of Botanic Gardens in the former Soviet Union. They got a special grant, and these directors came from the former Soviet Union to attend the meeting. And I was partly responsible for that, so I ended up being their chauffeur. They kind of thought I was just kind of the grunt at first, and not realizing that I was kind of the mastermind who helped make it happen. And so I would take them on field trips, and we went up to the mountains, and we went up to Mount Goliath, which is our Botanic Gardens alpine site. And we were up on top of Mount Goliath, and we were hiking down the trail there. And here we are at almost 12,000 feet when we start, and we're walking down to about 11,500 feet. And it's a big grassy slope, much of it. And at one point or another, I was sitting with them, and I was talking about what an excellent example it was of tundra, I said. All 12 of them just piped up immediately, and they said, no, this is not tundra. This is steppe. They were furious because I was referring to the alpine region that we were at right there as tundra. Well, tundra is a Russian word. Steppe is a Russian word. Taiga is a Russian word. Many of these geographical terms that are utilized for the north temperate region come from Russia, and the reason is that's what Russia is. Russia consists of tundra, steppe, and taiga. Those are the main bioregions, and they know what they are. And they knew that where we were on that slope was not tundra because tundra needs permafrost. Now, if we'd gone up another 1,000 feet to Summit Lake on Mount Evans, that was tundra, and they would have all agreed, and they did later on when we talked about it. But they know the difference between tundra and steppe, and alpine areas that have grass and that are exposed to that incredible wind and dryness, that's steppe. And so are our mountain parks. If you think about South Park, Middle Park, that steppe, wherever you get the sagebrush, and many of our subalpine meadows and So, in fact, steppe is interlarded throughout the entire mountainous region of the West, and it really defines even our forested regions are not as humid as the ones on the West Coast. As you well know, you're in Humboldt County. You get Usnea moss, that lichen that grows on the trees. It can get 2 feet long in parts of Washington and California because there's so much humidity. Well, we get Usnea, but only in the very moistest parts of our mountains, and our Usnea never gets more than a couple inches long.
Mm-hmm.
So we are much drier. Dryness defines the intermountain region and the steppe of the West. We are semi-arid with a dry wing, so to speak. And I think we really need to grasp the thistle.
Yeah, well, thank you for clarifying that for me and many of our listeners
sure.
who, I'm sure, live in high mountain communities and have been scratching their chins wondering if this really applies to them or not. So that's great. And I'm going to try to keep my mouth shut and let you speak forward more of this slide.
Well, we have we're only on slide 5, so I guess we should traipse along. For those of you who don't have it, imagine, if you will, I have a series of 4 pictures. And what the 4 pictures are is showing these incredible parallels you find in the 4 major steppe regions. And the first one I start off with is ungulates. And ungulates, of course, refers to those creatures that, various kinds of deer and cattle and all the herbivores of the world. A large proportion of them are entirely restricted to either savanna in tropical regions or steppe. And the reason why these matter so much is it's these ungulates that chew up the little trees and that are responsible, really, for the grasses and a lot of the plants that grow in these regions. And the ungulates once occurred in enormous numbers. We all know about the buffalo and the antelope in the American West. But if you think about in Central Asia, there were once vast herds of about 20 different kinds of antelope as well. Likewise, in South America, there's all the different relatives of the llamas and the alpacas and the guanacos that are native there, but many other plants as well. And, of course, South Africa is the homeland of so many different kinds of antelopes and all different manner of ungulates. Well, these ungulates are what have helped these plants. They've selected to be able to tolerate a great deal of grazing and abuse. And most significantly, we as human creatures arose basically as parasites on those ungulates. It's not a nice thing to say, but it's actually quite factual. We as humans have been dependent upon these animals, because even if some of us, I know, are vegetarian, but historically humans have lived off of antelopes. And the next slide actually shows one of the great dramas and one of the great stories that I don't think has ever been told very well is, as you can see, we arose as a species sometime maybe about 1 million years ago or 2 million years ago. The humans arose, or humanoids, evolved in Africa. And it took thousands of millions of years for the human creature to become certainly Homo sapiens. And you can see that for more millions of years, humans have evolved in Africa. So we really, that's our origins. And some say that there's a place called the Cradle of Humankind right near Johannesburg, and that's some of the oldest fossils. That's where we evolved, was on these steppe regions of South Africa and on the savannas of Africa. And we lived on these ungulates. And we followed those ungulates about 100,000 years ago. We crossed where the Suez Canal is now. It turns out there's a little land bridge there. We crossed into Arabia and the Sinai Peninsula. And the very first humans went into Eurasia. And what people don't realize is that this was one of the big, big banquets, because there were literally thousands hundreds of kinds of animals that had never seen a bipedal carnivore. So we decimated the fauna of Eurasia. And a lot of paleontologists now think, paleoanthropologists, that we are probably responsible for so many species becoming extinct all over the world we know for a fact in Madagascar and in Hawaii and in New Zealand that humans caused many of the large animals there, the giant lemur of Madagascar, the moa in New Zealand, and probably many of the Ice Age mammals in Eurasia, the mammoths and the various creatures. If you look up in Snowmass, where the Snowmastodons were, all of those animals that they found there are extinct. And they're finding evidence. They think they found evidence of human damage on some of the bones on those. Now, the reason I mention this is that there's this interaction between humans and ungulates in the landscape, and it took us eventually into North America and ultimately into South America. The steppe climate has been the superhighway of human evolution. We have evolved on steppe. And ultimately, we left the steppes and went into other climates, the Mediterranean and humid climates, and we forgot that we are steppe children. Mm-hmm. We are really, we're fashioned by the very landscape where we're now trying to garden, but we forgot that landscape. We have lost touch with our origins. So I think that gardening is a wonderful, powerful tool for us to come to terms with what we as humans have come from. And the next picture, I show petroglyphs from these four regions. There's the Anasazis on the upper left. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see I have, everybody's seen the lovely petroglyphs that you get in Utah and in western Colorado showing various kinds of animals. And here it has it shows that they have an antelope. And in Utah, it looks identical to a picture that I took in Mongolia of a bighorn sheep, and they both are actually bighorn sheeps. One is in southwestern America, and the other is in Central Asia, and those were actually one of the most preferred animals. There were more carvings of bighorn sheep in the southwest than any other creature, and likewise, the petroglyphs in Central Asia, we really have been dependent on sheep for much of our evolution. And the pictures in the bottom of this page show petroglyphs in Patagonia, and they look just like the ones in the southwestern America, just like the in South Africa. The Drakensberg Mountains and the Karoo have actually, the Drakensberg have been declared a World Heritage Site because of over 20,000 of those petroglyphs. And you remember we hiked up and looked at some in several different sites, and they look very similar to the ones in the southwest. This is our ancestors from tens of thousands of years ago. They have left a record of our human interaction with these antelope and these animals that allowed us to explode our population when we moved into areas where they were less wary. And that is a real secret to what we as humans have done and the part of the reason we've succeeded so much. And the next picture, and for those of you who don't have it, I can tell you. Yes.
Let me interrupt just a second to let you know. I told you that we were thinking of an hour segment for this talk, but you don't need to be rushed. I think everyone is enjoying listening to what you have to say. And since we won't be taking as many questions or no questions at this point during this segment, you can have a little more time if you'd like. Feel free to relax.
That's fine.
Okay.
Well, that's good. I'm just getting kind of excited, and that's part of the reason I've been speaking. So you could tell this is something I feel kind of passionate about.
Yeah, I love that.
Good. And the next picture is basically I have four pictures showing the cultural history of the steppe and the fact that horses and these animals are such an important part of the romance of human evolution. The picture on the upper left is of Frederick Remington's painting of cowboys. And then I show from the Ukraine, they have a picture of their stamps where they show off these Cossacks and how important the horses were in Central Asia to the Mongols. And then in South America, of course, we have the gauchos. And then in South Africa, of course, they have the Khoisan herdsmen. They have a huge history of animal-human interaction in Africa. So there's a long history of animals and humans and plants interacting in the steppe regions. So the other parallels that I really want people to be aware of is that the steppe regions actually are you are what you eat, and what we eat is largely step plants. So what I list in the next slide are the principal families of plants that are found in all four of the steppe regions. And if you think of what these families of plants are, basically it's most of our vegetables. What do most of us survive on? Well, the grasses, rice, wheat, corn, those are the grass family. And the grass family is the most important family of steppe plants. And the second most important is the bean family. So you find these same families, and they predominate in all of these regions. And I just list a few more of the families, the figworts, the cresses, again, there's so many cresses that we eat, and bulbs. And these same families of plants produce the ornamentals that we use in our gardens. And we should be looking to these families because they're the ones that are particularly adapted. So the grass family, that's why we're doing more and more with grasses in our gardens. The bean family has a lot that we can do, not just lupins, not just a few. There's a lot more wonderful ornamental beans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an important theme. It's important to let the landscape teach you what to grow and look and see what is actually growing in that landscape. And I show, the next slide is actually showing where most of the cultivated plants that we eat were actually first cultivated in or near the steppe regions. The corn, of course, is the most important grain in the world right now. The corn is something that was domesticated in the steppes of Mexico. And then Central Asia, you have the wheat, Brassica oleracea, which has produced all the different kinds of cabbages and Brussels sprouts and all of those. That's just one species of plant that evolved with humans, and it's a wild wheat of the steppes. And likewise, South America and South Africa have tomato is a plant that is found in the margins of steppe regions in parts of Peru and further south in South America. And then, of course, South Africa has a wealth of different kinds of gourds and watermelon evolved there. So we are really, you are what you eat, and we eat the steppe.
I like that.
And our vegetable gardens, if you think about it, the first thing you have to do is get rid of the big trees and whatnot if you're going to grow a vegetable garden, and you create kind of a peat-a-cal soil, so to speak. So a vegetable garden is kind of a recreation of a patch of a steppe prairie, and you grow these sort of glorified steppe plants in it that are our vegetables. Mm-hmm. So I think the more you think about it, I think the more that you realize that the land has a great deal to teach us. And these geography ideas are not abstract. They're very practical.
Yeah, I wish I felt like it was easier to grow vegetables in my clay soil. But we'll talk about vegetables more in a later talk in a few weeks.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, I think it's like everything else. You have to just sort of figure out the tricks.
Of course.
And it's always it's tricky to grow vegetables in many different situations, and as challenging as it may be for you, imagine how hard it is to grow vegetables in a climate where it rains all the time and where the soil is waterlogged, say, for example. So maybe things aren't so bad.
No, they're not so bad. They're pretty great.
No. Good. Great. My next slide is a picture of the actual how the Earth has evolved over the last several million years. It really goes back to the Mesozoic era, and where the plants in these various steppe climates evolved was probably along the shores of the ancient Sea of Tethys. So I show, if you look on this map, it shows you a little bit how the continents have drifted apart, but they probably took with them the origins of many of these plants that predominate in these four regions. So they're actually probably related. And I also I want to dwell a little bit on the grasses. So I have a slide showing grasses in the four steppe regions, and these are all happen to be grasses that are now growing at Denver Botanic Gardens, and they're extremely ornamental. The picture in the upper left is of Indian grass, which is found as a native plant in the Front Range area here, and it grows all over the tall grass prairie as well. Sorghastrum nutans, incredibly ornamental. And it looks remarkably similar to the Korean feather grass, which is in Plant Select, Calamagrostis brachytrica, which comes from Asia. And in the lower panels, I show pampas grass growing at Denver Botanic Gardens. Here it is from the pampas of South America, but we have a hardy form. And finally, sourgrass, Merckx Mueller macuania from South Africa. We actually are growing this at Denver Botanic Gardens. And all four of these grasses look have a very similar sort of look to them. And that's because these are the predominant elements in all four regions.
Yes, they are all very lovely with those nice plumes of flowers or seed heads blowing in the wind.
And so I'll do the next series of slides that are showing the same sorts of things. There's these extraordinary parallels in each family of plants that are predominant in these regions. You can actually find plants that look almost identical to one another. My next slide shows plants in the figwort family, the Scrofulariaceae. And there's a penstemon in the upper left from a picture I took over in near Glenwood Springs. And then there's a veronica from Turkey next to that from the Asian steppe. And then I have a plant from South America called Oricia, which is a picture I took when I was in the Andes. And then finally in South Africa, there's another scrof that looks just like a penstemon called Aptosimum. All of them have that brilliant blue color and the typical little monkey face flowers. And it shows you that these parallels are very, very strong. And you can find these parallels in almost any group I've sought. For example, the next picture, if you go on the next page, shows you cushion peas that are found in all four regions. They happen to be different colors, but you can find similarly colored plants in each of those families. And these are all plants in the pea family. In the upper left, you have the American milk vetch, Astragalus aureoides from Wyoming. And then you can see the Asiatic milk vetch, Astragalus angustifolius. That's one growing in my garden, but it originally came from Turkey with that tight dome. And then that brilliant scarlet Anarthrophyllum from the Andes. But it has that same habit and very similar flowers, you can see, and a Lotanonis from South of Africa. Isn't that intriguing that each of these families produces these twins almost?
It is. It is the Anarthrophyllum. Anarthrophyllum. Say that again, please.
Anarthrophyllum desideratum. Isn't that an amazing color?
It's amazing. Is that one that has any future here, do you think?
I think it does. We actually I have some growing in pots, and I know there's a nursery that also got some seedlings, so someday I hope we might have those. But we are the first generation that's growing many of these plants because these are not plants you can grow in England or in Holland. They need the sun. They need the steppe. And when people talk about how difficult it is to grow plants, it's difficult to grow plants from humid climates, but it's easy to grow plants from our climates.
Mm-hmm.
The next slide is really to point out that the steppe regions are where the world's great mountains are. And it's part of the reason we have steppe is that these mountains create these rain shadows. So I start off with the Rockies, obviously, in the upper left. You can see pictures, a picture I took in the Mosquito Range. And then I have a picture on the right-hand side of the Tian Shan Mountains of Central Asia, and then down below the Drakensberg Mountains, and then finally the Andes. The reason we have steppe is that it's these mountain regions, ranges are what cut off the rainfall from the ocean and have created the steppe. So mountains are an integral part of the steppe experience. Well, we're almost at the end of the slide presentation, and I hope I've been vivid enough so that if you don't have a slide, if you aren't actually looking at it, you can get a little bit of verbal image. The next one is actually some pictures of my expedition that I took to Mongolia a few years ago now. I label it what I did last summer, but I've been very fortunate to have been to all these steppe regions on plant expeditions, and probably one of the most exciting was one I took through the Altai Mountains of Mongolia 2 years ago, and it shows the camel trek. We had 10 camels carrying our gear, and we went over a high mountain pass over 11,000 feet, and it was very, very exciting. And from that top of that pass, I took a picture of a beautiful primrose called Primula xanthobasis, but it's almost identical in the way it looks to our native mountain primrose in Colorado, Perry's primrose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just to kind of bring it to a specificity. We can talk about all these generalities, but there's these very specific things. And that particular trip to Central Asia was one of the highlights of my professional career. But it also alerted me to the fact that there's an awful lot we don't know yet. And my last, the last picture of my slide shows four of the most beautiful flowers I've ever seen. And they, we found them in the Altai Mountains of Kazakhstan and Mongolia. And they are two columbines, which are every bit as beautiful as our Colorado columbine, I think. But they're totally unknown in cultivation. Brilliant blues, giant velvety blue flowers. And then I have a Dracocephalum and a gentian that are new to cultivation. They've not been cultivated in Colorado to speak of. And we got seed of all these, and we're growing them. And you can see I end on this blue note with these beautiful, brilliant, velvety blue flowers because I think blue is kind of the color of hope and promise. And I think the steppe is really a vast promise for our gardens because there are so many wonderful plants that are much better suited to our gardens than much of what we're already growing.
Indeed. Yes. Thank you so much for sharing all of those ideas. And I was so just inspired by how you weave together all of these big ideas going around the world and tie it into our own gardens at home. And I, on that note, I'd like to ask you if there are any resources that you might want to refer our listeners to be able to know how to better bring these plants and these concepts home to their gardens, because going to the nursery, you aren't necessarily going to know where a lot of these plants originate from.
Well, that's true. Unfortunately, you know, we don't have a huge literature of gardening in the steppe regions, but we've remedied that somewhat in the last few years. There's a couple of writers, regional writers, who I think have done phenomenal work. Lauren Springer Ogden is certainly, I think, one of the greatest. Her book, The Undaunted Garden, has just been completely rewritten, re-updated with all new pictures. Lauren's work is some of the most inspiring work, I think. And she has, in fact, she has three books that have just come out in the last few years, one on garden design that she wrote with her husband, and another one that's come out on 200 great plants, xeriscape-type plants. Bob Nold is a wonderful writer here in Lakewood who's written books on columbines, on penstemons that are really classics of their kind, and he also wrote a book called High and Dry, which is really a wonderful book about growing some of the more interesting Western dryland plants. Finally, the Botanic Gardens has produced several books, one called A Flourish, and we also did a book which is still in print, and then we did a book called Gardening with Altitude. The book called Durable Plants for the Garden, unfortunately, is getting kind of rare, but you can still find it in a few spots. That's about the Plant Select program, and I think Plant Select is a really good method because most of the plants in Plant Select are really step plants, and there's a lot of information on that program. Finally, the nurseries and garden centers, the independent garden centers of the Rocky Mountain region, are an unusually good resource. They almost all have classes. A lot of the people who work in them are trained professionals who really know their stuff. I think your independent garden centers are a place I really, you know, send people, as well as come visit Denver Botanic Gardens. I think we have a lot to teach people here.
Yes, I think you certainly do. I have been a member for as long as I've lived in Colorado for my big one or two trips a year, and everyone is so worth it. And I want to thank you for making it such as amazing as it is at the gardens, because I know you've had a lot to do with it. And I want to let the listeners know real quick that Pat Hayward, who runs the Plant Select program Pan AOT just mentioned, will be one of our speakers in upcoming weeks. Just check the schedule online, and you'll receive emails letting you know too, as well as Bob Nold, the author of High and Dry. They'll both be joining us, so that's very exciting. So thank you so much, Pan AOT, for those incredible resources and sharing your wisdom with us and all your years of experience and travels and education. It's just been really wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Well, and I love being one of your participants, and I look forward to actually listening in on some of your future programs.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to that too. we'll have a number more of good ones. So we'll be in touch. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, Eva.
All right. Bye-bye.